today on Against the Grain. Reasoning may be something we do, but reason is an idea whose content and fate have been debated and discussed over the course of two millennia. I'm CS. UC Berkeley historian Martin Jay joins me to discuss his new book, Reason After Its Eclipse, on late critical theory, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Many have been tempted to think, in times of relative peace and prosperity, that the world is moving toward ever greater rationality, that reason, with a capital R, is in the process of becoming realized. Notions like that take a hit when times turn dark, when, for example, fascism rears its ugly head, and then people wonder, what's happened to reason? What's happened to rational thinking, and how did this, you might call it, crisis of reason, how did it arise, and what can we do about it? A collection of thinkers associated with the Frankfurt School, which was established in Germany in the 1920s and then relocated to the U.S. because of Nazism, a number of Frankfurt School thinkers grappled with what they saw as a kind of crisis of reason, with different thinkers taking different approaches to the question and coming up with different ways to address it. The ideas of two Frankfurt School philosophers, Theodor Adorno and Jürgen Habermas, are among the many ideas investigated in a new book by Martin Jay, a book called Reason After Its Eclipse, on Late Critical Theory. In the book, Martin Jay, a history professor at UC Berkeley, describes how Adorno looked to art and aesthetics for answers. For Adorno, writes Jay, art was not the betrayer of reason, but rather its salvation. Jay also examines the very different approach taken by Habermas, a second-generation theorist of the Frankfurt School. Jürgen Habermas, in his effort to restore a robust notion of reason, pointed to a rationality rooted in the give and take of communication, of giving reasons and persuading through logical arguments and listening to the arguments of others. When Martin Jay joined me in studio to discuss Reason After Its Eclipse, I began by asking what concept of reason he was claiming or observing had been eclipsed.
This is an impossible question to answer, and in fact, I address precisely the impossibility in the introduction to the extent that the defining of a concept, the limitation of a concept, the belief that you can create a single univocal meaning of a concept is precisely what intellectual history tries to avoid. What intellectual history is most interested, I think, in doing is tracing the sometimes adventitious, sometimes meaningful, let's call it pilgrimage or the adventures of a word or a term or a constellation of terms over a long period of time. So reason, not only in English, but in all the various other languages, going all the way back to the Greek logos and Italian ratio and a lot in between, reason has had many, many different meanings over time. So what the book tries to do is to be fair to the variety of meanings and not privilege one as the essential meaning. Now, having said that, the Frankfurt School itself, the people about whom I'm writing in this book, did have an implicit normative notion of reason, which was, in their eyes, eclipsed in the modern world in favor of a debased version, which they saw as essentially instrumental. So even though I'm being a little reluctant to give you a definition, they, I think, implicitly held on to a normative notion. Now, one of the arguments of the book is that they never fully, at least in the first generation of critical theorists, never fully defended a viable notion of what that alternative to instrumental reason was. They derived some of it from Hegel, some from Kant, some from other metaphysical sources, maybe even theological sources, sometimes psychoanalytic sources, but there was never an absolutely coherent version. So the second generation of critical theorists, most notably Jürgen Habermas, had to provide a kind of paradigm shift in which a different version of rationality became his normative standard against which instrumental reason was measured. And so the book tries to tell the story precisely of that shift from the first to the second generation, with Habermas's alternative communicative rationality being the new norm.
And by instrumental reason, you mean reason used as a means to some end?
Max Weber was the first really to point this out, that there was a substantive notion of reason, one which emphasized values, emphasized ultimate, we might say, concerns, ethical as well as cognitive. That on the one hand, and other types of reason, formal and most importantly for our purposes, instrumental, which emphasized the rationality of finding means, finding instruments to achieve ends which were themselves arbitrarily and contingently given. So instrumental rationality was basically the rationality of a kind of efficiency, a kind of willingness to suspend the deeper question of why you were doing something. So, for example, you might have in, say, a wartime situation, a goal of winning a battle, of winning a war, and you might use the most efficacious way of doing that, which would perhaps be to wipe out the population, civilian as well as military, against whom you were fighting. But this doesn't, of course, raise the more difficult ethical question of who should, in fact, be seen as an enemy and who should not. For what reason is the war being fought? Is it possible to minimize collateral damage? And all the other things that are ethical questions. So instrumental reason essentially brackets the ends, sees them as arbitrary and irrational, and reduces reason to merely its means-ends possibility.
Now, in the eyes of the Frankfurt School, the first generation, is there a way to generalize about what they saw instrumental reason coming out of? In other words, what they saw instrumental reason replacing? What was the prior version of reason that maybe they approved of or maybe they felt was more benign than instrumental reason?
The first generation basically held on to a notion of what might be called an emphatic or objective or metaphysical notion of reason, which was a notion prior to the reduction of philosophy to science and the triumph of modern technology, one which emphasized the role that reason played in creating a nexus, we might say, of means and ends, in which the ends were themselves rationally chosen. Now, what makes it particularly difficult to figure out exactly where this notion of objective, non-instrumental reason could be located is that there was a metaphysical residue which said that somehow it existed in history. It existed out there. It existed in social relations rather than human interaction, understood as the process of giving reasons or the process of reasoning. So that there was what might be called an inherent reason in the world, which was a residue of a certain metaphysical idea that the world itself, because it was the creation of a rational God, could, even though we may not fully understand it, be at the deepest level inherently rational. Now, there are two versions of this, we might say. One is the, let's call it conservative version, which is that the world is, with all of its apparent and, let's say, surface or, let's say, contingent irrationalities, on the deepest level is reasonable, is rational, is somehow meaningful. And one might argue this was best expressed in the work of the 17th century philosopher Leibniz, who contended that there was a principle of sufficient reason underlying all the happenings that occurred, even those that seemed most basically irrational, even unethical. So he came up with a theodicy which said that partial evils were part of a general good. So this is one version. The second version, we might call it more or less Hegelian and certainly Marxist, was that reason exists but not yet in a rational form, that the world is potentially rational. The world has the tendency to become rational. The world is, in complicated ways, moving through an historical process which has as its goal the realization in the institutions and practices of humankind a version of reason. But here, too, it happens, if not automatically, at least on a level that is almost like providence in the religious sense, something that happens behind the backs and even against the wills of individuals. And this was a version of Marxism that emphasized it as an automatic process of, you know, basically social revolution producing outcomes that would be beneficial to humankind. So the Frankfurt School, to some extent, depended on this latter version, but basically became disillusioned with the Marxist notion that this was inherently happening in a meta-narrative of historical progress, which left them with a dilemma, because if reason was not already in the world, and reason was not, in a way, the telos of the world inevitably happening in a future, then it left it, in a way, hanging in air. And there was no, we might call it human agent or social agent, bringing about reason. It had to be done by will. It had to be done by practice that was not yet in place. And there was a kind of, we might say, loss of faith in the possibility of rationality finally being achieved. So to some extent, the Frankfurt School fell back on a rather desperate utopianism in which, although the present was growing increasingly problematic, and remember they're writing many of them during the period of fascism, and the Enlightenment, instead of being a progressive, upwardly mobile, we might say, phenomenon, was dialectically going also in a negative direction. This is the idea of the dialectic Enlightenment. They were left with really no hope beyond a kind of, we might call it, faith and prefigurative ciphers of utopia, maybe in art, maybe in other aspects of human imagination, but certainly not sufficient to create much confidence that reason would be achieved in the near or even in the far future.
So you focus part of the book on what Max Horkheimer, a leading member of the Frankfurt School, thought about reason and what had happened to it and what the future might bring. What did Horkheimer contend is the disease of reason?
Well, this is a very troubling question, because I mean, if you have a notion that there was once a robust, positive, let's call it objective or emphatic notion of reason, which is then replaced by a diminished instrumental version, then it's a fairly simple narrative of decline. If you replace that with the notion that from the very beginning, from the origins of human logos and human use of reason to survive in a hostile world, there is always already a kind of negative fatality in which reason is used for self-preservation, and self-preservation involves basically dominating a hostile environment, which creates a kind of technological instrumentality which becomes inherently anti-human and certainly hostile to nature in its more benign forms. So this version of reason is one which is so pessimistic that one might argue it's impossible or virtually impossible to believe that one could ever overcome this original sin of rational interaction with the natural world and somehow create a benign and more nurturant relation with nature, because self-preservation is still so much an obvious human concern and an understandable one.
Martin Jay joins us in studio. He is Sidney Hellman Erman Professor of History at the University of California, Berkeley. And I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Martin's latest book is Reason After Its Eclipse, on Late Critical Theory. It's published by the University of Wisconsin Press. Let's talk about Theodor Adorno, another very prominent thinker and member of the Frankfurt School. You referred earlier to art. Some members of the Frankfurt School, especially Adorno, looked to art and aesthetics for perhaps a way out of this crisis of reason. So what did Adorno think that art could do to or for reason?
Adorno, of course, wrote very extensively on art, both in terms of specific genres, music and literature in particular, but also in general, and especially in his Aesthetic Theory, his posthumously published final book. So it's very difficult to give a kind of soundbite version, because he was extraordinarily complex in his thoughts. I mean, I would say that he was very much in favor of the necessity in the current world of supplementing philosophy, supplementing, let's say, theorizing about rationality, supplementing science in the sense of doing a kind of social scientific understanding of the world with the serious evaluation of a certain kind of critical art, a certain kind of now, alas, esoteric and in some ways elitist art, as a necessary way to avoid some of the implicit problems in an overly rationalist, certainly instrumentally rationalist, relationship to the world. So what did art provide? Well, negatively, it provided a sense of the, let's say, suffering that the world had not yet eradicated, that art should be a place not for simple entertainment or culinary enjoyment, but a place in which human suffering was given a kind of, let's say, concrete embodiment, one that would be felt on the gut level, not simply as an abstraction. Art also provided, through the imagination, a, let's say, semblance of or an appearance of something other, something different, something better. A promise of happiness was the phrase that they liked to use. It was first Stendhal's, then Nietzsche picked it up. Art is une promesse de bonheur. So art has not only a registering of suffering, but also in its form, in its stress on the bodily senses, a kind of prefiguration of a utopia of happiness. In addition to that, art, in a very, very complicated way, represented the protest of the, let's call it, non-identically unique particularities of the world to the abstractions of philosophy and theory, to the overly generalized versions of conceptual thought that reason too often abetted.
So in other words, these overgeneralizations, they tended to elide or ignore the particularities, and this was an effort to bring back the particularities?
The concept is basically, the German word Begriff means to grasp, and it means to take all the specific particular individual instances and subsume them under an umbrella concept, an umbrella idea, an umbrella notion, which then leaves no remainder. The aesthetic was precisely the place where concepts were inadequate. It was always something that was a block or in excess of, or something that needed to be added to the concept, which reminded us performatively of the inadequacy of a certain kind of rational thought, which was overly schematic, overly systematic. So art, in a way, is the refuge, we might say, of a certain kind of radical nominalist particularity, which is part of Adorno's hostility to the overly rationalist philosophies of, let's say, certain German idealists, even Hegel, whose work in many respects he admired. I mean, one of the difficult things, of course, about all this is that art itself, with a capital A, is a concept. So the minute you talk about art with a capital A, you're in danger of betraying the specificity of each work of art, which is always in excess of the genre into which we put it.
Did Adorno see art as standing apart from, standing outside of this nature dominating reason, this reason that was premised on self-preservation in the context of a hostile, threatening nature?
There was in art, you know, let's say a constellation of different impulses. One of them was indeed a kind of domination, that it was possible for art, like science or technology, to be understood as controlling the chaos of the world, controlling noise, controlling the entropy, controlling the irrationality of the world. So art gives order, gives form. And to this extent, we might say it partakes of the domination of nature, which doesn't want to be formed or shaped. On the other hand, there is a relationship in art that Adorno privileged, which he shared with Walter Benjamin, which was a mimetic relationship in which the art is not simply dominating, especially via a general concept, but rather in its embodied form, also pays homage to the reality external to it, to the material reality of the world, whether it be sound or the stuff of painting or sculpture or the words that exist on a page. So that there's some way in which art is both, we might say, complicitous with and also resists the domination of nature. And the mimetic moment in the aesthetic is one that he cherished. It's a relationship to the objective world, which is not one of control and domination, but one rather of a kind of, let's say, friendly homage, a kind of nurturant relationship rather than one that tries essentially to shape, control, and dominate.
What did Adorno think of the type of reasoning that goes into argumentation?
Well, this is also a complicated question. I mean, in the book, I make a principal distinction, goes back to the Greeks, between noetic and dianoetic thinking. Noetic thinking is more intuitive. It's a belief that somehow we get a gestalt immediately of a rational form. For example, if I look at a triangle, I see immediately what a triangle is. I don't have to be persuaded that it is a specific geometrical form. The opposite, dianoetic thinking, and dia has the Greek word for through, means taking time. It means persuasion through inference, through logical deduction, through giving evidence. It's something that involves a kind of intersubjective process of my persuading you. Now, there were some philosophers who were much more noetic. They got their ideas and simply presented them as if they were truths, without having to defend or to, somehow examine alternatives. Nietzsche would be an example. Nietzsche doesn't give you much discursive philosophy. He uses aphorisms where you got a kind of congealed assertion. Now, Adorno was, in certain of his moods, Nietzschean, and Minimum Morality is a text, a book written in 1951, of aphorisms, some extraordinarily brilliant, but which don't argue anything. They don't make a case for something. Elsewhere, he was willing to accept the need to do that and criticize figures like Heidegger for being overly hostile to giving reasons and for being discursive. But in comparison to Habermas, who is basically on the side of dianoetic discursive thinking, Adorno could be understood as more noetic. And one of the students of Habermas, Herbert Schnadelbach, called him a noetic of non-identity. That is to say, someone who believed in the inherent value of non-identity, particularity, non-conceptuality, as opposed to identity thinking, but didn't give an argument for it, didn't try to persuade people, just had the kind of basic intuition that there was something worth preserving and nurturing in the non-identical. And he had a noetic inspiration to do this.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Martin Jay joins us. He's an historian based at UC Berkeley, where he has taught since 1971. His latest book that we are discussing today is called Reason After Its Eclipse on Late Critical Theory. We have a link to that book and to his faculty page at UC Berkeley on our website, againstthegrain.org. Martin has also authored more than a dozen other books, including The Dialectical Imagination, A History of the Frankfurt School and the Institute of Social Research, 1923 to 1950, and Marxism and Totality, The Adventures of a Concept from Lukács to Habermas. He's also written a book about Adorno, or at least one book about Adorno. So, as you write, Martin, many people were not convinced by Adorno's argument, at least in so much as it proposed a kind of retreat into an aesthetic sanctuary. Can you elaborate on that?
Habermas called it his strategy of hibernation. In other words, there was in the Frankfurt School in general, Adorno in particular, a, let's call it, aesthetic unwillingness to force the marriage of theory and practice, to create an immediate link between a radical critical theory on the one hand and revolutionary or radical practice on the other. And this, of course, came to a head in the late 1960s, shortly before Adorno's death in the summer of 1969, when German students were very anxious to realize what they saw as the critical potential in the Frankfurt School's work. And Adorno said no, it was premature, it would be counterproductive, and wrote essays like Resignation, where he argued against the idea that he was simply resigned and had given up. So it was a very clear, strategy of moving away from immediate expectations of radical change, and a strategy best exemplified by a metaphor he uses in Minimum Morality, that of a Flaschenpost or a bottle thrown into the sea with messages for some future that would read them when the time was ripe to act, but not in the immediate future. So where does critical thought go? And one enclave, one redoubt was the aesthetic. And Adorno was very hopeful that in some versions of the aesthetic, and he privileged, say, writers like Beckett or composers like Alban Berg, that there was some sort of way in which art was a place that had, at its best, been able to hold on to the critical energies and also the utopian hopes that had fled from the world of practical politics. Now, for some people, this was basically too elitist, the famous image of the Grand Hotel Abyss used by Lukács, that is to say, these are privileged figures living in pampered luxury in a grand hotel, looking down an abyss, but simply bemoaning it from their secure perch. This was not something that people who wanted to have change now, you know, they did not find it satisfactory. Now, there are various alternatives, and Habermas was himself very, I would say, well, his attitude is complicated. And he was inspired by Herbert Marcuse in the 1960s. And Marcuse was the one Frankfurt School member, the first generation, who did try to find common cause with the students, both in Germany and America. And Habermas found in him a strong inspiration. And yet Habermas was also made anxious by what he saw as the counterproductive and potentially violent, and in the German context, particularly resonant because of the fascist background, methods used by some of the students. And he even, in fact, attacked, and this came back to haunt him, what he called the left fascism of these students. So Habermas retreated, we might say, himself, not into art, but for a while when he left Frankfurt and went to the Max Planck Institute in Starnberg in southern Germany. He retreated into a social scientific enclave, which was very much, he didn't teach, he was outside the university network. But he was never as, let's say, pessimistic about the public realm. He'd written, of course, a famous book about the transformation, the structural transformation of the public sphere, but he himself always remained active in it. And as a result, unlike Adorno, he did not feel a strategy of hibernation was called for, but rather one of, let's call it, radical reformism, in which some of the new institutions of the Federal Republic needed to be challenged, but others supported, in which revolution was not on the agenda, but at least it was possible to move in progressive directions. And he fought many, many battles in public, and still does, well into his late 80s to this very day.
In a book published by Habermas in 1962, and this might be the book you just referred to, he looked back in history for instances of people meeting and arguing about things on an equal footing. What did he find?
Well, to argue on an equal footing means that when you bring to the table in a discussion, in a public discussion, you bring to the table only the arguments. You don't come with the authority of your position, your age, your race, your gender. You don't come in with all of the attributes of power that allowed previous discursive context to be asymmetrical and hierarchical. Instead, you sort of strip that away as best you can. I mean, it's always an ideal rather than absolutely empirical reality. You strip away as best you can who you are and rely on simply what you're saying. And the hope is that other people enter the public realm with the same, let's say, self-limiting understanding. They don't try to pull rank. And they're also willing not merely to argue, but to listen to your arguments. I mean, in a way, this is the crucial, we might say, Habermasian move. And as you say, it's already there in the early 60s, a move of reciprocity rather than hierarchy, a move that involves not the I-it subject-object relationship, which is, of course, the basic relationship of the domination of nature, a subject, either the individual or the collective subject, dominating an object, the natural world. Not that, but rather what we might call a subject-subject or an intersubjective relation. So it's the second person rather than the first or the third person that's crucial, that I treat you as another person, I listen to you, I treat you not as an object, I treat you as a subject with all the same attributes, rationality included, as myself, the ability to suffer and so forth. And therefore, there is a kind of leveling of the playing field and an emphasis on giving reasons rather than individual rationalizing or deductive reasoning or instrumental rationality. So it's the necessity to justify, the necessity to persuade, the necessity to give the better argument rather than to either pull rank or to use the authority of tradition or to use the authority of revelation as the way to come to decisions which have a better chance, let's say, they're not by any means guaranteed, but have a better chance of being understood as rational and as worthy of being accepted by everybody in the discursive community.
And what historical examples did Jürgen Habermas find of this kind of venue, of this kind of arrangement
Well, it's an important question because it could be understood solely as an ideal and abstract, but he actually looked in the book on the structural transformation of the public sphere of the way in which it had developed in what he called bürgerliche Gesellschaft, bourgeois society in the 17th, 18th, 19th century. And there are a variety of ways in which this occurred. For example, in discussions, critical discussions of literature, the reading public discussing books and discussing other types, poetry and whatever, of literature. Then it also occurs in the growth of parliamentary institutions, in which it's possible, although, you know, these are always imperfect and there are many residues of hierarchy, it's possible to have people coming from modest backgrounds representing their communities and yet arguing on a level playing field about the merits of a particular, let's say, political program. It also occurs in the growing journalistic world. Now, journalism, of course, we know is deeply, complicated, imperfect, and commercially driven and so forth. We know that. But there's also in journalism, at least in its best form, a belief that evidence and plausibility and counter-arguments and listening to the positions and opinions of other people is part of what the game is all about. So the growth of a responsible press was also part of this. And then finally, maybe the most obvious one for people like me is the growth of the academy. That is to say, institutions, universities are only perhaps the most prominent, but there are other kinds of academies, for example, of science and so forth, in which people would get together. And basically, it didn't matter who you were, the argument was king. So these are all institutional embodiments of a certain kind of rational discursivity. But as the book argued, and as sometimes is forgotten, he fully understood that this was, quote, a bourgeois or bürgerliche privilege, and that there were excluded groups of people who were not part of the game, as it were. Gender, for example, plays a great role. Women were essentially excluded in a variety of ways from virtually all of these discursive communities. Workers were excluded. People who were in a colonial relationship were, at the beginning of the game, even still slaves. In a number of Western societies were obviously not part of the discursive community. So the community was both empirically limited, but we might say ideally unlimited. So the hope is that the initial constraints, being bourgeois, being a male, being a person of property and so forth, that these would melt away and that greater and greater inclusivity would allow people who had been previously silent to get a voice. Now, whether or not this has been true, of course, we can debate. And there's no question that, you know, people with certain types of means get greater access to the media. And, you know, we're by no means in a what Habermas would call ideal speech situation. But as a telos and hope and as a counterfactual possibility, it still functions. And if we have any hope for democracy, it seems to me that we have to at least believe that this is the fiction by which we measure decision-making rather than simply give it to experts or give it to alleged leaders who are charismatically chosen or people of breeding and tradition or all the other things that used to be the warrant for having power in a polity.
Martin Jay, history professor at UC Berkeley, and his latest book is Reason After Its Eclipse on Late Critical Theory. It's published by the University of Wisconsin Press. We'll take a short break and return and speak more with Martin about his book. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Martin Jay is the Sidney Hellman Erman Professor of History at the University of California, Berkeley. He's the author of many books, including Adorno, Marxism and Totality, and The Virtues of Mendacity on Lying in Politics, and we are talking about his latest book. It's called Reason After Its Eclipse on Late Critical Theory. So what you're describing about communicative rationality or communicative reason, which is kind of what Habermas was proposing, points in my mind to a process, to a procedure, and that might be opposed to or seen as very, very different and distinct from a concept of reason with a capital R, which, you know, you've been talking under some conception, it sort of exists in the world, it's developing, it's emerging in the world in a more and more sophisticated, perhaps more and more productive way. So, I mean, to what extent was Habermas really trying to maybe replace a static concept in some people's minds with something that seemed to be more about a path toward a goal of consensus based on kind of full-fledged argumentation among ideally equivalent actors?
Well, first of all, the goal is never to be really achieved. The ideal speech situation, perfect consensus, the end of debate, a belief that you can have a single position that will be shared by all of the human species, this is obviously an impossible goal. So that Habermas believes that the process of modernity, the process of enlightenment, the process of arguing, the process of discursive will formation is endless. And democracy, such as it exists, if we want to think of this as a political form, is always still to come. It's always in the making. We never achieve a fully formed democratic society. We're always struggling against regressions. There are always threats. And, you know, it's in this current political climate very easy to understand why one would almost think that it's an impossible goal. But nonetheless, as a, let's say, idea that's been already made meaningful in the world, it's very hard to put the genie back in the bottle. It's very hard to go back to a state of naivete about the authority of traditional elites, the authority of patriarchy, the authority of alleged breeding, aristocratic or otherwise. It's very hard also to give our trust to experts, to technocratic experts who allegedly can administer and who know best, because we know how easily they can lead us astray. So we're stuck in a way with the learning process, which has told us that unless we are willing to give reasons and persuade and listen to the reasons of others and be somehow open-minded about our conclusions, that we're not going to find real answers to difficult problems, that we may not necessarily find those answers through this kind of procedure, but without it, it would only be the most amazing stroke of luck that would get us out of our various dilemmas. So I think that in a way, it's an understanding of the fragile, vulnerable, but yet necessary means, procedures of using reasons, giving reasons in what Wilfred Sellers, the American philosopher, called a kind of space of reasons in which people who are willing to play the game, there are always some people who would prefer violence or coercion, people who are willing to play the game can in fact at least tendentially reach some sort of, let's say, fragile consensus about where we ought to go. Now, this is obviously, in a way, its own utopia, but maybe it's a more practical utopia, a more manageable one than some of the others that believe that reason could be a fully developed form of life and that we would end up with a rational economy, call it socialist, or a rational polity, call it, you know, a kind of rule of rational philosophy kings, or whatever the kind of alternative version would be.
And so this notion of kind of talking things through, how did Habermas conceived that in a kind of a temporal sense, in terms of how much time it would take, because talking through things could take a long time. It could cause or mean delays in making decisions on important matters that require rather expeditious action.
Well, you know, you're absolutely right. I mean, certainly from the time of, say, the Nazi political jurist Carl Schmitt up to the present, there have been many, many anti-liberal thinkers who think that liberal discursivity is simply a kind of delaying tactic which prevents you from making decisions, from acting, from being decisive, from being able to cut through the Gordian knot and actually do something in the world. And there are, of course, some, challenges which are precisely of the kind that do not allow the luxury of overly, let's say, indulgent discourse in which everybody's argument is heard, every refutation is considered, every person is included. I mean, it's quite clear that you can't wait to have an abortion. You have to decide now. You can't wait for 6 months, 9 months, 12 months. You have to have a decision. And, sometimes you don't have the full facts or opportunity to make your mind up, and you have to sort of act. So there are various moments in which that occurs. Now, the most, in a way, negative example of that, and this is a point that Elaine Scarry and other people have made, is the decision to start or to respond to a nuclear attack, where there's absolutely no discussion, where there's no decision-making on the part of the people who are about to be obliterated, where there's absolutely no democracy. And so in a way, that's the, we might say, limit example of communicative rationality, where one person has the ability to push a button, and there are no checks and balances, basically. There's an ultimate sovereign power, let's call it that, to act in a moment of emergency, a moment of crisis, without including even the people who are most involved and who will be victimized by it. So that's the least democratic possibility that we now have. I mean, one of the reasons to get rid of nuclear weapons, if we can ever do it, is that it is the exact antithesis of democracy. There's no discussion, especially if you're afraid you're about to be obliterated yourself. But in many, many other cases, delay and discussion can avoid a premature and in some ways impetuous decision. So, we recognize in hindsight that sometimes actions were made without really thinking through the consequences. So it's to some extent, although, a principle, it's also a case-by-case issue. And some cases we have the luxury of discussion, others we don't. It's also, of course, possible in certain instances to reopen discussion. So, we had, say, a scientific consensus about eugenics at a certain point. Well, we then discovered that eugenics produced pretty terrible outcomes, and so now it's much harder to avoid discussing issues of, say, the manipulation of DNA without remembering the horrible implications of the eugenics experiments of the past. So there's a kind of what Habermas would call learning process in which the later discussions benefit to some extent from the mistakes made or the omissions of the earlier ones. But it's an excellent question because I think, as anybody who has to make a hard decision knows, sometimes you just have to say, look, we've talked enough, we must act. We hope we're acting on the basis of best knowledge and best values, but we can't be sure, but we must act. And, Habermas, I think, is fully aware of that.
Martin Jay joins us on Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Martin is a professor of history at the University of California, Berkeley, where he has taught since 1971, and we are discussing his most recent book. It's called Reason After Its Eclipse on Late Critical Theory. So there seems to be a fairly important assumption at play here, Martin, which is that people can be persuaded, by logic, by rational argumentation. And it just seems to me that so much of recent history, and maybe ancient history, not necessarily recent history, shows that if you talk to your political opponent and you trot out facts to support your case, you're trying to persuade that person over to your side, for example, often it's not really the facts that matter to that person. It can be an emotional pull. It can be, in some cases, language coming from a demagogue who is not really speaking based on logic or facts. So how does Habermas deal with that particular phenomenon?
Well, there's no question that you can give many, many examples of mystification, of seduction, of rhetoric being used basically to, seduce people into believing things that are not in their best interests and so forth. So that in the realm of politics in particular, and I've written more about this in this book on lying in politics, the idea that logic, reason, evidence will dominate is probably a very naive one. Having said that, one might argue that there is always a mix, a balance. There's always some way in which, even though we have very hard and fast opinions, which don't always allow themselves to be changed through persuasion, there is the capacity, at least, to treat the opponent, not simply as an enemy to be defeated, not simply as someone who can be either shouted down or circumvented through manipulative strategies, but also to some extent respected as a person who also has the capacity to make arguments. So if we learn to listen to the arguments of the other people, even though they may be given in forms that we dislike, and if we perhaps persuade them that some of our arguments are more than just self-interested, a little bit of progress is made towards resolving problems rather than using force or using manipulation. Now, this is always an imbalance, and one can be very pessimistic and easily give examples of this failing. But there are moments in which it is possible to, let's say, create tentative consensus based on evidence, argument, and the presentation of facts and the presentation of logical inferences and so forth. So I think it's always a question of how you tip the balance rather than either or. But, you know, certainly after the recent election, one can't feel very optimistic in the short run about how, you know, politics of rationality is winning out over politics of deception, manipulation, and let's call it rhetorical hijacking.
So you said earlier that Habermas understood that, you know, this notion of an equal playing field where everybody could get together and sort of on an equal status talk and argue and make assertions and try and justify them and listen to each other, that that's kind of an ideal, and that, you know, some people are excluded from the debate or the venue. Some people within the venue might have more authority or more influence or maybe even just talk louder than other people in the room. That seems to me where political struggle might come in, where, you know, struggle might be required and you would think is required in order to level the playing field. Is that where Habermas, or is that part of where Habermas located a notion of what struggle had to occur?
Well, there's no question that it's an ideal which has not yet been achieved, and so therefore to achieve it, there has to be a strategic action. There has to be willingness to use political means, which include sometimes confrontation, and at the extreme, although one hopes very rarely, violence or coercion in, you know, the sense of, let's say, the police powers of a state or the military powers of a nation, so that one has to recognize that as the kind of limit condition. So it's really a question of once again, a balance. I mean, you can't ignore those aspects of politics, but there are counterproductive implications of relying on them entirely. So that if you get rid of the idea of discourse and argue that only a vanguard party or a group of elite scientists and administrators and technicians, only they really have power, then you end up sometimes suppressing alternative positions which may have a kind of wisdom in them, which may express, once again, suffering and also utopian hopes, which the administrators, the vanguard party, even may not fully understand. So there is always, I would say, a tension in politics between the necessity sometimes of, you know, acting in ways that are not perfectly in accord with this ideal model. That on the one hand, and yet hopefully pushing towards the greater inclusion of people and allowing a normalization of it as a reality which does not need the emergency situation of, let's say, non-discursive intervention. But, you know, this is, once again, a very difficult moment to try to push this argument, simply because we've seen through the new technologies, and this is something that Habermas, of course, doesn't talk about in his first book on the public sphere, new technologies, an extraordinary explosion of voices, a kind of what might be called anarchic democratization, in which hierarchy and the vetting process and gatekeeping and all the things we associated with traditional media, newspapers and television, whatever, all this has gone by the board. And now you can, you know, tweet and get a million followers or have some scurrilous, you know, false information put out online and no one can check it until it's too late. So we're in a kind of weird situation in which it's almost as if too many people without any vetting are given credence. And we see this perhaps most alarmingly in the debate over climate change, when experts scientists, maybe 98% of an exact number of scientists, believe that it is a real problem and caused by human intervention, can be weighed against a much smaller group of people, many of whom are much more dubious scientists than the scientists at all, and yet they can be drowned out by the latter because, you know, you can have these voices which are allegedly of equal merit. So it is a great conundrum in a way. You know, you want to include, you want to avoid hierarchy, and yet at times there are people who are credentialed and who have greater or should have greater, let's say, cultural capital to be heard. And this current technologically abetted moment of anarchic inclusion is one that is the kind of reverse of what Habermas had hoped for.
So we've been focusing on really two chapters. We previously agreed to do this, two chapters of your new book, Reason After Its Eclipse, the one on Horkheimer and Adorno and Marcuse, all, again, thinkers in the Frankfurt School tradition, and then Habermas and the Communicative Turn. What else is in this book?
Well, the book tries to provide, although, of course, it knows full well, or I know full well, of its inadequacies, a longer, let's call it secular history of the fortunes of the varieties of term or meanings that have been, let's say, sheltered under the term reason. So it goes back to the Greeks and spends a considerable amount of time with Greek notions of logos and mutos and the ways in which they're either disentangled or entangled. It also spends a lot of time with the Enlightenment and talks in great length about Kant and Hegel and their versions of reason, and then also argues about Marx and rationality. I mean, Marx is a very complicated figure who, to a certain extent, was indebted to the German idealist tradition a la Hegel, and yet obviously wanted to find a relationship between reason, understood ideally and inherently in the world, and part of this teleology of ultimate rationality, wanted to find a relationship between that and the material forces that existed in the world, forces that involved the human body and the suffering of the laborer and the suffering of people who were oppressed in general, and wanted to find some way to operationalize, to use a more recent term, operationalize the hopes that rationality would one day be achieved. I draw quite a bit on a book by Alan McGill, who talks about Marx and the burden of reason. And one of the arguments he makes, and I think it's an interesting one, is that Marx perhaps was overly reliant on a singular notion of a reason that was embodied either in the historical process or in a party, maybe even a la Lenin, a vanguard party, that could represent the general will of the population, and we might call it the rational general will of humankind. And that as a result, Marx was himself rather impatient about the messiness of political pluralism and the possibility that one has to give reasons in the Habermasian sense and listen to the reasons of others, and instead could be autocratic in his understanding of reason, which may have led, we might say, to the technocratic vanguardism of 20th century Leninism. So I think there are interesting relationships between those figures and the crisis of reason that I talk about solely within the Frankfurt School tradition.
Martin Jay. Again, the book is called Reason After Its Eclipse on Late Critical Theory. Again, on againstthegrain.org, you can find a link to that book published by the University of Wisconsin Press, as well as a link to Martin's faculty page at UC Berkeley, where he is Sidney Hellman Ehrman Professor of History. Martin, thanks so much for joining us.
Great pleasure to see us. Thanks for the terrific questions.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, as Albert Einstein once said, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources and links, and a way to sign up for our podcast. And check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio.